Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of American Warrior Radio. On September 11th this year, the nation's largest 9/11 memorial tower climb will take place, the largest using both first responders and military personnel. That will be taking place here in Tucson at the University of Arizona Stadium. Parallel events will be held the same weekend in Phoenix and Flagstaff. Now, the Tower Challenge raises funds for various agencies that provide critical support for the families of injured or fallen first responders and military. But the objective of the event, since the very first time it was held by Tucson firefighters and Tucson police officers, is to assure that we, as Americans, never forget. That we never forget those 2,996 souls who lost their lives that day. That we never forget the first responders who sacrificed their lives running toward danger rather than away. Now, quick programming note before we get to our guest today. He was there on 9/11. He lost comrades on 9/11. He spent days shifting through the remains of the towers, and he's got a powerful message to tell, so stay tuned. But a quick programming note, for those of you tuning in to hear country music star and former Ranger Craig Morgan, apparently BBG can't do math very well, much less calculating the time differences, so we're going to have to reschedule Mr. Morgan for a future date. But don't fret, we have an excellent guest today, someone I've been wanting to have on the show for a while, someone who's made a career out of pulling people's fat out of the fire, just like he's doing for me today. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Jimmy Gagliano. I think.
Grab me.
There you go, Jimmy. Yeah, listen, I really appreciate this. I go to Havoc Journal all the time. It's become my kind of my go-to resource. You, among other things, write for Havoc Journal, and you've got some very, very powerful things on there. I really enjoy reading them. Congratulations on that, Jimmy.
Well, I appreciate that. The folks at Havoc Journal have done an outstanding job of basically providing a platform for veterans, for folks who want to write about their experiences or just write about issues that are relevant to veterans. So certainly something that members of your audience would be interested in. And it's a free site. You can go there and access the writers. They've probably got about 25 or 30 different usual authors, and then they also have special guests too. So I appreciate the platform they give to me. My writing is much more, I think, pointed towards the law enforcement realm because that's where most of my background experience is. But I did spend 4 years in the regular Army, so I do have that kind of connection. But the Havoc Journal is a great resource. I agree with you.
Now, Jimmy, you're bona fides, if I may, for our listeners. You mentioned you were in the Army. You're a West Point graduate. You earned the coveted Ranger tab and served with the 10th Mountain Division. 25 years as an investigator, you led SWAT teams. You're a part of the FBI's elite hostage rescue team, which I want to talk more about. You're an undercover agent. You've been a legal attaché. I love this line, Jimmy. It says, you led tactical and diplomatic operations in Afghanistan, Mexico, and parts, quotation fingers, of Africa, Europe, and Middle East. Those are the parts we probably don't talk about, right?
Well, it's funny, Ben, but I always tell people I've had a great 33-year experience in serving the country, and whether it's in the military or law enforcement, and I did a lot of different things, and I didn't really get stuck doing one particular thing, and part of it, I think, was a blessing because it gave me a good perspective on many, many different parts of how our federal government works, whether it's domestically or overseas. But I also laugh and say it was probably because I wasn't particularly good at any one thing, so I had to continue moving before they caught up with me. But I had a great experience, and you pointed out some of the different assignments that I did have, worked with some amazing folks. And interestingly enough, I entered the United States Military Academy in 1983, so we were kind of at the height of the Cold War at the time. And then when I graduated, became a second lieutenant, you know, it was still, you know, during the period of time, yeah, the wall was about to come down, but we were, as far as deployments go, my furthest deployments in the Army with the 10th Mountain Division was out to Fort Irwin, California, or Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, for training. And it literally wasn't until I got into the FBI in 1991, of course, the Gulf War happens, and I feel like, oh my gosh, I missed an opportunity to serve in combat and to do what I'd been trained to do. But then as things kind of worked out, timing is everything, right, in life. I ended up getting to experience parts of short tours over in Afghanistan during the global war on terror, and as part of the hostage rescue team, which you mentioned, traveling to all parts of the globe on different types of missions. So it's just interesting that my time in the military was spent mostly stateside, domestically, but as soon as I left and went into our domestic premier federal law enforcement agency, the FBI, that's really what gave me the opportunity to serve overseas, which I don't regret. I had some great experiences.
Well, and you great experiences that you share in your writing, Jimmy. And also, you know, we've been keeping our eye on you. You've been auditioning now for a while for American Warrior Radio by serving as a legal analyst for CNN. You know, I'm very pleased to say you finally made the grade, and, you know, now you can come on American Warrior Radio.
No, I definitely appreciate that. I know you and I have been trying to work out some dates. You were very gracious in reaching out to me, and I'm happy to be here because I know that your audience is primarily, not primarily, but it's made up of a lot of veterans or folks that are connected to the service in some way, and these are the kind of shows that I do like to go on and connect with folks like that that kind of have similar interests and backgrounds. The CNN gig was kind of an unexpected thing. When I retired from the FBI in December of 2015, I thought my job was just going to be to teach. It's kind of something that I really was kind of earmarking myself to do at the tail end of my career. I wanted to be able to give back in a capacity of being in a college classroom and teaching undergraduates. And St. John's University in Queens, New York gave me a wonderful opportunity to do that. And I was literally between classes. I had a break in between classes, and I got a call from one of the senior vice presidents at CNN following the bombing in Chelsea that happened in New York City back in September of last year. And they asked me if I wanted an opportunity to come in and talk about it from the legal analyst perspective. I said, sure. So I did that for about 7 or 8 months, just off and on, as different things would happen over the course of the last 8 months. And then when the FBI director got fired by President Trump back on May 9th, they called me in, and that day they offered me a contract. So I enjoy it. As you and I discussed before, my job on there isn't politically related. It is strictly to call balls and strikes on the law enforcement end, which is a lane that I'm comfortable being in. So I've been on to talk about terrorist incidents or mass shootings or even some of the stuff related to, you know, the FBI director's firing and the search for the new FBI director and those type of things. But I try to keep it strictly to the realm of just calling balls and strikes and speaking about processes and protocols versus getting into the partisan political realm.
Well, I tell you, Jimmy, your writings on Havoc Journal are anything but dry or cold and statistical. I tell you, you had an article. Ladies and gentlemen, go to havocjournal.com, H-A-V-O-K, journal.com, and look up an article called Earn This. And I wanted to have you on today, Jimmy, because I tell you, well, for a while now, because I read that article and it's so powerful, talking about not just your experiences on September 11th, but sort of what you were involved with leading up to what happened on September 11th to our country and to your comrades. And very, very powerful stuff. So I'd like to chat more about that in the context of the Memorial Tower Climb we have here. I tell you, I feel very strongly that we must never, ever forget. And I think you and I maybe share a worry that we're drifting away from that. So when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about that. In particular, one poignant line, Jimmy, that you wrote in your article. You were talking about the time you were putting together an investigative team at Trinity Church there by Ground Zero. And you said, and I quote, "For those of us charged with protecting America, we blame this lapse of deadly consequence on ourselves." Ladies and gentlemen, this is American Warrior Radio. We're joined by retired FBI Special Agent Jimmy Gagliano. We'll be right back. We're talking about 9/11 and some other things. Stick around, folks. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very pleased to be joined live on the phone today by Army Ranger and FBI Special Agent retired Jimmy Gagliano. Jimmy has got an amazing piece on the Havoc Journal called Earn This. It really touches on some issues surrounding September 11th, before the event itself and after. Jimmy, I kind of teased earlier about your quote about, "For those of us charged with protecting America, we blame this lapse of deadly consequence on ourselves." That particularly rang for me because you had the background and the experience prior to 9/11. And I want to kind of get back to this HRT team. You were actually deployed as a member of the FBI, and I think a lot of us don't know that much about that we do have FBI teams over in some of these countries doing special stuff. Tell us a little bit more about that and your mission involving the USS Cole and your time in Yemen.
Sure. Well, the FBI's hostage rescue team was formed in January of 1983, and the purpose of it was, the FBI director then at the time was Judge William Webster, and there was a concern amongst the U.S. government that with the impending Los Angeles Olympics coming up in 1984, we did not have a counterterrorism team, a team that could operate within the United States. Remember, you can't use Delta Force or SEAL Team 6 or, you know, Posse Comitatus is a law that precludes you from using, you know, military special operations units to, you know, do regular policing or to conduct operations inside the United States. And so there was a decision that was made that there was a need for a civilian counterterror team, and that essentially was the genesis of the hostage rescue team. It was basically trained and formed down at Fort Bragg, worked with a lot of the spec ops teams that are housed down there, modeled after the British SAS and modeled after some of our own teams. And then going forward, it conducted a number of different missions, most of them in the realm of renditions, going overseas to pick up folks that that the United States were picking up from foreign governments that were going to come here to face judgment. They were also used for high-risk arrest, special barricaded subject situations that happened in the United States. And back in 1997, I was posted there from 97 to 2001. And in, I believe, December of 2000, when the USS Cole was bombed by Al Qaeda by the men that were on a small fishing boat, and it had come out in the port of Aden and basically discharged a bunch of explosives and blown a hole into the boat, because that warship is U.S. soil. You know, just like an embassy is overseas, you know, the United States FBI has purview over the investigation, and we were dispatched to kind of handle the security on the ship for the investigators while the ship was still listing and filling with water and trying to be stabilized so it could be brought back to the United States. So I kind of had a first-hand, up-close perspective, and that's where I met one of our service martyrs, John O'Neill, which is one of the two FBI agents that were killed on 9/11 in the Trade Towers. John had literally just retired from the FBI a week earlier and assumed the position as the head of security for the World Trade Center and perished in the South Tower trying to help folks escape. But John was our leader over there. He was the special agent in charge of New York City's FBI division's counter-terrorist branch. So had an opportunity to work very closely with him. You mentioned that the piece is called Earn This, and where I got that title from is from watching, I'm sure people are familiar with Saving Private Ryan, and movie came out in the late 90s and was filmed by Steven Spielberg, directed by Steven Spielberg, and was, you know, based loosely upon the D-Day invasion, and then of course this one team of Rangers who are going to try to locate this Private Ryan. And when the captain, who's the leader, played by Tom Hanks, at the very end of the movie is about to die, he tells the young Private Ryan that they had gone to save, hey, remember, the rest of your life, earn this. You know, earn the fact that these men on this team gave their lives to get you back home. And I always thought that was a special two words, earn this, to a lot of us, you know, who have like survivor's guilt, and that's kind of what it is, you know, as I alluded to in the Earn This piece on Havoc Journal. If not for a dentist appointment that morning in Queens, you know, I would have been down in the towers because my office was just a few blocks away. I usually came into work early to the gym, and I was streaking toward the towers that morning after rerouting from going to Queens, and there before the grace of God, got down to lower Manhattan, got down to the South Tower just a couple of blocks away when it came down. So, I mean, it was all based on timing. You also referred to my lamenting about lapses. I mean, it's the stories are legion about the problems between the intelligence community in the United States, the FBI and the CIA, not being able to share information in the fight against terrorism. And that was true. You know, there were these walls put up, and some of them are necessary when you're dealing with confidential information, but some of the walls were stupid, and they were internecine battles between U.S. federal agencies. And it's the same thing. The FBI's had a history, you know, historically of, well, we don't share information with local law enforcement. We expect to gather it from them, but, you know, the information flow comes one way. It doesn't go the other way. If there are any silver linings in what happened on 9/11, it's the fact that it's forced us, not just in the military, but at the upper echelons of the government and certainly in law enforcement, it's forced us to work together, because to prevent the next 9/11 and any type of criminal act you see with these mass shootings now and these ISIS-inspired events where folks go and they shoot up a place, like the Pulse nightclub in Orlando or the shooting in San Bernardino, anything like that. The first responders are not going to be the FBI. It's not going to be SEAL Team 6. It's not going to be counterterrorism operators. It's going to be local police officers. They're the first line of response. And so I think the only thing in the 16 years since we've come out of the, you know, the 9/11 and what happened and that terrible tragedy that day is it has caused us to look at things differently and to work together as opposed to everyone having their piece of the pie, their territory, and getting, you know, I've got a proprietary interest here and I'm not sharing this with you, which is part of what led, I think, to the failings in the intelligence gathering before 9/11.
Now, Jimmy, you lost two comrades on 9/11, and like you said, but for the grace of God and a cast on your leg, it might have been you. And I want to show you both photos of both Special Agent Lenny Hatton and Special Agent John Patrick O'Neill are on display, and every one of those climbers that does the Memorial Tower climb will be looking into their face and their eyes as they climb those steps to replicate what they went through on 9/11. As I understand it, Special Agent Lenny Hatton, he actually went to the top of the adjacent building to relay information to FBI, and then when the second tower was struck, he literally went into the World Trade Center to help out and lost his lives. And then you mentioned Agent Patrick O'Neill. He's regarded by most people as the guy who tried to warn us, isn't he? I mean,
you characterize Lenny's service and martyrdom perfectly. Lenny was a former Marine. He was a special agent bomb technician. He had special skills and talents, and he felt like they could be used there inside the tower that morning and essentially helping people get out but trying to get a good handle on, you know, what we were dealing with. I mean, obviously it was aircraft, aircraft fuel that was burning it was a towering inferno, two towering infernos, and Lenny went into the building to position himself to try to get a better idea on what could be done to get people down from the top that were above the crash zone. Just a superb agent, father, husband, just an unbelievable man. And then you mentioned John O'Neill, and you characterized that perfectly. He has been lionized as the man who tried to warn the world about Osama bin Laden. I mean, I don't think most of the world really knew who Osama bin Laden was prior to 9/11, but John O'Neill certainly did, and he pressed the fight continually with the upper echelons of the Bureau and the U.S. government to recognize that Osama bin Laden was not just some radical cleric, but was a guy with the resources, the financial resources, the wherewithal, and he's a leader. I mean, you know, we can talk about, you know, we don't just say somebody's a leader because they do good things. I mean, there are bad leaders, and he was one of them. He was a charismatic leader who did awful things, but I think John O'Neill recognized that. He recognized that this man had the wherewithal and the funding and the savvy to put something together like what he did on 9/11, which I don't think going forward you will see things of that nature, that type of a large-scale attack, because the planning and the amount of people that have to be involved in it, and it's just too difficult to do with our better sources now and our ability to intercept communications, which is better. It's too difficult to do. I think what we're going to be seeing, and what John predicted too, was we're going to be seeing soft targets like we've seen in London, and we've seen in parts of the UK, and we've seen in parts of France and Belgium, attacks on softer targets. But John O'Neill was absolutely the man credited with trying to get everybody's attention that Osama bin Laden was a force to be reckoned with.
Well, and I tell you, Jimmy, we want to make sure that people don't forget so we don't repeat the same mistakes. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to help us memorialize those folks and raise money for a good cause, visit the Never Forgotten Tower Climb website, 911towerchallenge.org. They're taking registrations now to participate in that climb, a very powerful event. Jimmy, when we come back, I want to get into more of your experience on that day. There's several poignant moments that you mention in your article. You know, one is the glance you exchange with the police officer when you were negotiating your way through that barricade on your way to the towers. And then also just the horrible, horrible vision of Americans, fellow Americans, jumping from those towers. And as I mentioned to folks, you know, but for the grace of God and the fact that you had a cast on your leg, you would have been part of that tragedy there, but you were involved. So, folks, again, this is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. We're talking live with Jimmy Gagliano, an Army Ranger and retired FBI special agent, a very, very expert on this subject matter. Stick around. I think you'll enjoy it. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some Greg Morgan concert tickets. Just got that out, so stick around. Hey, listen, if you want to help us send out these messages, visit patreon.com/American Warrior Radio. For the cost of a cup of coffee a month, you can help us spread these very important messages. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. We're joined live on the phone by Jimmy Gagliano. Jimmy's a retired FBI special agent. He's done all kinds of things. He is the law enforcement analyst that regularly appears on CNN. Just a great guy. Listen, before we get back to Jimmy, now's your chance. Greg Morgan tickets. We've got a pair of tickets for the first two callers, 751-1041, courtesy of Desert Diamond Casinos. First two, because you know what? We don't give away participation ribbons. Either you're first or second, or you lose out. Give us a call, 751-1041. The concert is Saturday, July 15th at Desert Diamond Center in Sahuarita. Doors open at 7. The show's at 8. If you've not heard Craig Morgan perform, you're in for quite a treat. And he's also just a huge supporter of the men and women in our military. Jimmy, have you ever heard Craig perform?
I have not, but I can promise you after this, I am going to look him up and take a listen.
He's an amazing guy, great singer. You know, as the story goes, he had a chat with his commanding officer, and his commanding officer said, you know, I think you could be a sergeant major if you applied yourself, but frankly, you know what, maybe you ought to give this country music thing a shot. And, you know, now he's just huge, and he does a lot. In fact, he raises money to provide free homes for veterans. Just a great, great guy. I want lots of USO tours. So give us a call, folks, 751-1041 for those free tickets to hear Craig Morgan in person. Jimmy, back to you. What you write is so powerful, and it's very well written. It just, you know, I get the strong visual images in my mind. So if we could this segment, let's just talk about your experiences that day. You mentioned that, you know, you're an early riser. You say that, you know, normally for your job, you didn't have to report to the office till later in the morning because, I think, as you said, drug dealers usually don't get up too early in the morning. So, but you're an early riser. You like to be at your desk at 7:30. But on that morning, you had a dentist appointment to get your tooth fixed. So sort of walk us through that. You're driving into the city, I'm guessing. And what was your first – did you get a phone call? Did you hear it on radio? What was your first indication that something was amiss that day?
Yeah, Ben, like you said, I was an early riser. I typically got down to the FBI office, which was in 26 Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan, about six blocks north of where the Trade Towers are. And I would normally get down there early enough in the morning so I could beat traffic in, get a workout, grab my coffee, read the newspaper, be at my desk ready to go by 7:30, 8 o'clock. And on most of the drug squads, this was a joint FBI-NYPD counter-narcotics task force. So most of the drug squads worked like 10 to 6s or 10 to 8. So you would work a later shift because, again, you know, you're not gonna be surveilling drug dealers at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. They typically didn't get up till noon, and then they were doing most of their nefarious deeds late at night. So that's the way that our schedule was. But I used to get in early, and this morning only because my mother had been nagging me for weeks about, you know, hey, have you gotten your teeth cleaning? You know, my mother was still looking after me at that time in 2001 when I was a grown adult, but she was doing what moms do. So I had an appointment scheduled that morning. I'm riding in, and I get a phone call from my brother-in-law, who works. He's a security executive for Verizon, and his building was in Midtown, but it looked down toward the Trade Towers. And he rings me up. He says, "Hey, you're at your desk, right?" Because normally we would talk probably once or twice a week in the morning. And I said, "No, I'm in the car." And he goes, "Well, there's a bunch of smoke coming out of one of the Trade Towers." So I said, "That's interesting." I turned it over to 1010 Winds or one of the news stations, and I start listening, and then the second tower gets hit. And then I knew. And I just literally, I was headed to Queens, which is, you know, if you're familiar with the layout of the five boroughs, is east of Manhattan. I re-vector down, and I go screaming south towards Manhattan. And when I got to the Triborough Bridge, which I think now is called the RFK Bridge, but as I referenced in the piece, you know, nobody was being let through. All the ingress points into Manhattan were locked down. The NYPD and the TBTA, the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, had locked them all down. Of course, I had lights and siren on my car, and I flashed the police officer who was blocking the entrance there, and we locked eyes. And it was at that moment you could still see downtown. You could see the plumes of black smoke. And we looked at each other without saying a word. We both knew we were at war.
Mm-hmm.
And I got onto the Harlem River Drive, which is runs on the east side of Manhattan, down into the FDR. And it was the most eerie thing because I'm going probably close to 100 miles an hour on a road that is normally choked with traffic at this point in time in the morning, and there is not another car in either direction. I drive the length of Manhattan. I get to the Brooklyn Bridge exit, which is right down where I would normally get off to go to my office, and obviously is the exit where you could get off to go to the Trade Center. I have to ditch my car there because pedestrians are streaming over the Brooklyn Bridge. People are escaping out of Manhattan. And I jump out of my car and start running toward the towers. And again, timing. You mentioned I had just had ACL reconstructive surgery on my knee, and I was hobbled because it was a soft cast, but I had a cast on my leg. And trying to get down to the city, something that would have been six blocks from the Brooklyn Bridge, give or take, to the Trade Towers. It took me the better part of 20 minutes. Now, I was fighting through people, and, there was chaos in the streets, but that time saved me again because as the first tower came down, which I believe was the South Tower, I was a couple of blocks away. And you point out some of the imagery that I will never forget. In 33 years in the government between the military and the FBI and traveling all over, as you pointed out, and I've seen some things. I've seen man's inhumanity against other men throughout the course of my career. I've seen awful, awful things, but I don't think anything will ever be as seared in my memory as looking up and following human forms as they were coming out of the upper echelon, the upper reaches of the Trade Towers, because where the planes hit I think it was the 80th floor in one building and maybe the 70th floor in the other building, all the floors above that, with limited exception, the people above the crash site were trapped, and they ended up either jumping to their death or perishing when the towers collapsed. And so that was just such a vivid and searing memory for me of watching that. It was heartbreaking because you're so close to them, and there's nothing you could do to help them, Ben.
Well, and Jimmy, I would think, that image is just such a horror is the word that comes to mind. I mean, you can use the words chaos, Armageddon, confusion, but horror comes to mind when I think about those images of those human beings, people with families, Americans, jumping out of those towers. And well, I get, the other thing that really struck me, Jimmy, is you're trying to find a place, you're trying to get settled, you're trying to get your med kit because you're trained to help people. They were trying to convince you you couldn't go in the building to get your med kit. But the other thing that really struck me is you wrote that when the first tower came down, you felt it before you heard it.
Yeah, it was, and listen, I struggled in engineering at West Point, so I can't say that I'm gonna rely on that. But the way that the Trade Towers were constructed and the way that they basically imploded, that they collapsed on themselves, and I got to tell you, from things that I've read and watched on, National Geographic in the studies since, I mean, we're lucky that the towers came down basically in their footprint, because if they had collapsed, either to either side or any side, there certainly would have been even more loss of life that would have taken place. But the actual feeling of the floors pancaking on themselves, I've heard stories of people saying they were as far up as north of Houston Street, and even closer up toward Midtown, that could actually feel the reverberations of those floors pancaking and the tower collapsing on itself. I mean, it's a surreal, it's something that you'll never, ever, ever forget. And I'm sure the people that were closer in the Pentagon and certainly the tragic heroic souls that were on Flight 93 that crashed in Shanksville, but those experiences of people in D.C. that were around the Pentagon and experiences of people that were in Lower Manhattan, you will never, ever, ever forget it. It was such a visceral feeling, and it's something that, as American people move past things, we have lots of memorials. We have Memorial Day, and we have plenty of things, days that we honor people and honor, our nation's heroes and things like that. I think it's something that, you know, everybody should be aware of, and I'm glad the event that you're talking about. I think that's a wonderful thing, because it's been 16 years since the towers came down this September. And I think what we forget about in our nation's 241-year history, Ben, this war that we're in, that we're still engaged in right now, this war that we're in Afghanistan and still in Iraq, and there's parts of it that are spilling over into Syria, this war that we're engaged in is the longest conflict that the United States has been engaged in since its birth. 241 years and a 16-year war that we're still engaged in that's not done. I think we need to remember that and reflect upon that. And as we go about our lives and enjoy our day-to-day existence, remember there are people that are still in harm's way trying to preserve our way of life.
There you go. Jimmy and folks, if you'd like to register or help out, you can visit 911towerchallenge.org to sign up for that tower climb. Jimmy, when we come back, I want to pick your brain a little bit more about some other things sort of related to this. But I'm glad you mentioned that. I was at a change of command. It's change of command season here, and I was at a retirement ceremony, actually, for a pararescueman, an Air Force PJ, just an amazing fellow. And there was a three-star general speaking at that event, and PJs, you know, their tempo of deployment is very, very high. And this general admitted, he says, look, we're seeing deployments, we're seeing tempos. The DOD has not seen anything like this before. We're not quite sure how to deal with it, but we have been at war. And that's I want to just emphasize to folks, there are men and women out there who are still fighting this battle. We may not think about it on a daily basis, but they're out there, so think about it, folks. Hey, Mark, congratulations. Mark won our first pair of tickets, the Craig Morgan concert. We got one more pair left. Give us a call, 520-751-1041. When we come back, we'll finish up our conversation with retired FBI Special Agent Jimmy Gagliano. Stick around, folks. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by retired FBI Special Agent James A. Gagliano. Jimmy to his friends. So I'm gonna take some privilege and call him Jimmy and hope I don't get put on a watch list somewhere, Jimmy. Listen, folks, go to havocjournal.com, HAVOK journal.com. Look for James got some great articles up there. Today we're talking about Earn This, discussing his experiences on 9/11. And I am not capable of properly communicating the passion and the images and the quality of writing that James mentions on down to. You know, one segment, Jim, you talked about when you were going, you know, getting ready to go back, nobody knew what was going on, and, you know, you strap on your service sidearm, and you talk about how it'd been wrapped with skater's tape because of all your time and deployments overseas and just the feel and knowing that you had that tool at your side as you're going into this. Not enough time to cover all the things I want to cover, so let me just sort of pick your brains on a couple of things. Your experience, as we talked about, you've been deployed overseas in some cases as an attaché on the diplomatic side, and you talked about the difference there. I was raised overseas, and I've talked to people that have been involved in the Middle East, and the importance, whether in war or law enforcement, of knowing those sometimes discrete cultural differences. As Americans, we sometimes make the critical error of operating through the lens that we think the rest of the world thinks that like we do, they're all motivated like we are. And sometimes that can come back and bite us in the patootie. So what's your sense on that, Jim?
Well, I think that's a great point. Understanding the cultural differences is very important. Understanding what's important and what type of religious symbology or customs, you know, shouldn't be breached, and just certain sensitivities. Now, sometimes it makes it difficult for what we're doing. And Ben, I'll go back really quickly to the 2000 attack on the USS Cole. When the FBI investigators showed up, you know, 3 days after, by the time they got there, 3 days after the Cole had been attacked, we dealt with at the time an ambassador who was very, very strict in her adherence to, hey, you've got female investigators here. Well, you're in the Middle East, so they can't have their arms exposed. So even though it's 100 degrees in the shade, they've got to have their sleeves rolled down on the utilities. And they can't have their shirts tucked into their pants. They've got to have them pulled out because it would be a sign of disrespect in the Muslim world. You know, they're wearing cargo pants, so we need to kind of downplay it as best as possible. Now, I can certainly understand those predispositions towards wanting to, you know, hey, we're in another country, but we had been under attack. And at the time, I think it made for some difficult relations. And John O'Neill was kind of instrumental in working through those because, you know, at the time we wanted to roll our sleeves up, go to work, figure out who did this, and then go get the bastards. But that wasn't kind of, you know, when you're dealing in the diplomatic world, it's a different bear. I experienced it a little bit in Mexico. In Mexico, I served in parts of 2013 and 2014 as the deputy legal attaché and as the acting legal attaché, which was the FBI director's direct representative to Mexican law enforcement and the Mexican government. So I worked out of the embassy, and I had meetings with folks up as high up as the attorney general for Mexico at the time, who was a gentleman by the name of Murillo Caram. And I think one of the huge things that I think broke down some walls, and I say walls in a figurative sense, not a literal sense, but one of the biggest thing was I had agreed to go to language training before going over to Mexico. Now, I didn't, other than a couple of words that you hear on TV, I couldn't spin, and, you know, my little one watching Dora the Explorer, I didn't know any Spanish words. So I went to an immersion course with the State Department for 6 months. My Spanish is fair. It's middling. I scored well on the test, but I mean, it's middling. It's conversational. But I think that went a long way towards establishing some bridges and some beachheads with senior officials in the Mexican government. First of all, senior officials over there, they all spoke fluent, beautiful English. But the fact that I would try to conduct business with them in Spanish, they were so patient, they were so gracious, really made the experience good for me, since I knew that listening to me speak Spanish must have been like listening to nails on a chalkboard. but they were so gracious. And it's one of the things I say to people that come to this country, you know, no excuses. Don't tell me we have to hang on and only speak our native tongue. We're not going to learn English. I said, hey, I was 48 years old, and the older you get, the more difficult it gets for your brain to wrap itself around a different language, because you're just too ingrained and indoctrinated in your native tongue. But it was so important as a sign of respect to the country that I was posted to and serving in. And plus, it just gave me an ability to experience things that I never would have experienced it if I said, well, heck, you know, the folks in restaurants in Polanco or in Mexico City, they speak English, so why should I bother? So that was a cultural thing, I think, that was very, very important in establishing rapport.
You know, Jimmy, I'm glad you mentioned that. I had a personal experience, and I was part of a trade mission to Beijing, and we're having dinner with the kind of the equivalent of their Speaker of the House in the Great Hall of the People. And the embassy, when they briefed us, they warned us. They said, look, all these guys speak perfect English, but they're going to use a translator because that gives them just that few extra seconds to think about what you're going to do. And we're challenging them about their one child policy at the time. And, boy, you talk about an aha moment. The guy turned, he stopped his translator, and he turned and he addressed us in perfect English directly, which that in and of itself was a sign. But he says, look, no offense, but you don't get it. If we didn't do this, given the numbers, given the geometry of it, our nation would starve. And, boy, you talk about it. You know, and look, I'm proud of America. I still think we're one of the best darn experiments in government ever. But those things sometimes happen, and I just think it's important for us to sometimes put those lenses on when we go out there. Jimmy, about 3.5 minutes, and this is not fair, but I do want to ask your take on this real quick, if you don't mind. July 7th marks the one-year anniversary of the ambush and assassination of the Dallas police officers. 4 days ago, we had a New York police officer, Mia Soto's familia, who was ambushed and killed. When you talk about earn this, you talk about how we need to move forward. We've moved on, but do you really think we've moved forward? Do we just now face a different challenge here domestically? You got 2 minutes.
I think the political divide, the partisan political divide, has done a great disservice to us. I think back, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you're old enough to appreciate that. 30 years ago, I think people could have political and ideological differences and they could do it civilly and politely. People can't do it anymore. You can't be a Giants fan in a Boston Red Sox bar. You can't, you know, you've got to pick a side, essentially. And unfortunately, people don't condemn you for your ideologies. They condemn you because you don't share their ideologies. And a big part of that is, as we move towards diversity and greater diversity in this wonderful, as you said, you know, this democratic experiment that we've been enjoying for 241 years, we want diversity in everything. We want one of everything. We want one of this, one of that, one of this color, one of this sexual orientation, one of this religion. We just don't want diversity in thought. We don't want people to think differently than we do. And if they do, it's not just because they think differently, they're evil. And a big part of this chasm, I think, goes toward what's going on with law enforcement right now. As has been said many times before, former FBI Director Jim Comey gave a brilliant speech. You can Google it in February of 2015 at Georgetown. It was called The Hard Truths in Law Enforcement. And he talks about the divide, the chasm between the inner city and law enforcement. It's a brilliant speech, and I think it's well worth your listeners to pull it up and read it. And he confronts some uncomfortable truths, you know. Yeah. Yes, there are racist cops, but they are an infinitesimal. They are, you know, one-tenth of one-tenth of one-tenth of one-hundredth of one-tenth of 1%. The vast majority of folks in law enforcement are drawn to it for the same idealism and zeal that people go to serve their country in the military. They want to help. They want to do good things.
Well, and I tell you, Jimmy, I'm going to have to stop you there. I'd love to have you back on to talk about that because that's a whole other subject matter. I just want to kind of preview it. So, Jimmy Gagliano, thanks so much for your time. We look forward to having you back on American Warrior Radio, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Ben, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
There you go, folks. You can find podcasts of this and other interviews at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Don't forget to visit 9/11TowerChallenge.org to find out how you can help register and participate in an event so we'd never forget these men and women whose lives have been impacted by the attacks on September 11th. Once again, folks, until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care, Tucson.